Welcome to another episode of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
Free advertisement of the day?
Yeah.
What are we into?
I don't know. What are you into?
Four Winds Jewelers. They've been great. And I saw Carl Bott from the station in there. Apparently they've been advertisers since the station opened. Huh, who knew? And I love them. They fix all my watches. If you have any old watches, especially mechanical, you know, wind watches, Jim over there does all the fixing. And if you need your rings tipped or sized or any of that stuff, they do all the work in-house. And they do an excellent job, and the pricing is terrific. So that's Four Winds Jewelers on Hilltop Drive. Can't miss them. And so let's see. Let's do some tiny bit of housekeeping. The archives. The archives moved them, actually, because we had too many years. Goes back 15 years. So I scooted them all over to make room for the incoming 2026. And just so you know, they are free to access, free to listen to. They're just MP3 files. We hope you make use of them. I don't have everything grouped by category, but categories where I had enough shows to put them all on a one page. Wolves, pot, transgender stuff, Klamath, China, environmentalism. God knows there's plenty there. Shows with veteran focus, South Africa. I've got a ton of shows on South Africa, Islam, and then all the government and national security. I'll probably add this one. I don't know if I should add it to Enviro Craziness or government and national security. I think I'll add it to both
yeah,
pages.
You should.
So today we're, you know, it's funny. I've run into a couple people who have heard of this issue, but mind-blowingly, probably 95% of the public is completely unaware.
Anybody that's heard about
that, there is a looming gas crisis in California. So today we have with us in studio Mike Ariza, and then on a conference call we have Professor Michael Miché and Assemblyman Stan Ellis. So I have listed all of their bios and all of those things. Today is December 28th, 2025. And we hope you had a Merry Christmas, by the way. And unfortunately, we're going to ruin your new year before it even starts.
We're going to give you something to look forward to.
Oops. Yeah, sorry about that. Should have done something cheerful. So Mike was born in Fairfield, beautiful downtown metropolitan Fairfield, I'm sure, at that time. Raised in Vacaville, went to Vacaville High School. He was in the Navy, so shout out to you on the Navy service. Thank you for that. And you worked, I'm just going to summarize, you were at Chevron Oil Refinery. You were at Exxon Valero at the Benicia Refinery for a long time, and Flying J Refinery in Bakersfield. And now you're at California State Chico.
CSU Chico.
Professor Miché is the Associate Professor of Practice of Management and Organization. He's widely sought for his independent and objective perspective, exceptional consulting acumen. That's what we're tapping into today, his consulting acumen, boardroom skills, and direct Socratic data-driven client-centric style. Sure, say that really fast. Of addressing highly complex and critical strategic organizational, operational, and positioning issues, which obviously this is all of those things. He's been a member of the USC faculty since 1997, and he coordinates the USC's Marshall Management Consulting undergraduate and graduate curricula programs. I have his CV on there as a PDF if you would like to peruse. It's really pretty interesting. And then Assemblyman Stan Ellis. He is a farmer, local businessman, and community member with deep roots in the Central Valley. Grew up on a hog farm in South Dakota and worked to put himself through college at South Dakota School of Mines and Technology. And he graduated with a degree in mathematics, settled in Kern County, and has an extensive entrepreneurial career where he wandered into politics somehow.
Oops.
And discovered the joys of the California legislature. We'll leave that for another show. Haven't we all blundered into that? Not as deeply as poor Stan. So now that I've kind of laid out the cast of characters, I guess we should identify our voices, huh? So tell us something. Mike, where would you like to start? We'll go through where everybody wants to make sure we don't miss something.
Well, where to start? This has been going on for a while. I took interest in it when I heard the Valero was shutting down. So I'm farm myself and work at the university. It didn't really catch my attention until I heard Valero was shutting down. Valero is the most efficient refinery in the state.
And they supply a lot of California's supply.
Yeah, 10 to 11% of the gasoline, and they make another 12 to 14,000 barrels a day of jet fuel and diesel. And when they go down, we're going to lose about 10% of our supply. We're already right now with Phillips 66 is down, Marathon, Refinery Martinez. They're on 17,000 barrels a day of renewable diesel, but the 170,000 barrels a day of crude oil they used to bring in is shut down. So all the gasoline, all the jet fuel, the propane they make, it's gone. Rodeo Refinery converted over to renewable diesel. They're at rates of around 45,000 barrels a day of renewable diesel, but they also their gasoline, the jet fuel, everything they made, that's all gone. So with those two refineries down, we've lost 18 to 20% of the 38 million gallons a day that California still consumes of gasoline. And then Phillips 66 shut down on October 17th. They're in the final stages of that, so that's another 8 to 9%. And then Valero, originally they were going to shut down in April, but they're going to go ahead and apparently shut down in January as they canceled their crude oil contracts over 2 months ago.
Oh, wow.
So the state tried to get them to stay open, and they basically told the state, no, thank you, we're out of here. Valero makes about 10 to 11% of the gasoline that's coming into the state. So the total, with Valero going down, basically 40% of our gasoline jet and a huge percentage of our jet fuel and diesel is going to be coming from Singapore, South Korea, and from India.
And we can't import that because California has their own blend. Is that right?
Hold on, boys. We're jumping ahead.
Oh.
We need to identify the voices of everyone so that we can actually have a conversation and people will know who they are, because we don't know what they sound like either. But now that we've laid out some ugly math, let's bring in Professor Miche, who has 43 years of global management consulting experience, and in 43 years, I'm sure he's going to give this all an F. If we stick with the school theme, I think probably Gavin Newsom gets an F, yes?
Well, Gavin's grades aren't very good. This is Professor Miche, and thank you so much for having me on. It's a real pleasure to be with you today. It's a great way to start, right? I've been following this industry since 1973 when I was an undergraduate. So I got into energy economics during the energy crisis of 73 with the Arab nations' embargo of U.S. oil supplies. The United States, and just began studying it. I mean, it was just a great industry to study. And then, of course, I started my career on Wall Street and then went to KPMG, became a partner, and then ultimately ended up at USC when I retired from the partnership. So it's been a lifelong study of mine. I love the industry. I love the economics of the industry. It's really fascinating to me. And I think if there will be a textbook written on this, and it'll be called All the Wrong Moves made by California and the legislature, and in particular our current governor. You know, when you look at some of the statistics, and we'll get into those when you're ready, they're pretty dismal, and they could have been entirely avoided, okay? But nonetheless, we are where we're at, and I'll let my good friend Assemblyman Ellis take over from here.
Yeah, we mentioned the California legislature. Cue Stan Ellis. So, Assemblyman Ellis, how much fun are you having? Uh-oh, he's in the cone of silence.
I don't know that he's on the phone.
Oh.
You might want to...
Well, he's having so much fun, he's not on the phone. I mean...
we said California legislature, and he's like, oh, this must not be for me. I better get out of here. Oh, my God.
Called the wrong number.
Yeah, I'm sure we'll
get him.
Yeah, Mike's gonna text him. So tell me this: when you say that this is totally preventable, and you've been looking at it since I was 12, Have we teetered this close?
You're making me feel bad.
Yeah, but at least I was born. At least I was born then. You know, it's when they say, you know, 30 years ago, and they look at you with that deer in the headlights. You're like, oh my God, you're right. I was born like way before that. So when you say it was avoidable, avoidable recently or avoidable a long time ago? Like how long have we been marching toward the cliff?
Been marching toward the cliff for quite a while. When you began to see these refineries, we had over 40 of them at one time, right? Began to decline, and then somewhere around 2005 is when we shifted from being more in-state production to being more reliant on imports. So we were fairly consistent in our production, in our dependency on in-state production all the way up until about 2005-ish or so. And then it switched, and we began more dependency on imports, particularly from Saudi Arabia at that time, and which was our number one producer and our number one supplier of oil for a long, long time. And so we saw ourselves becoming more dependent on the imports from these foreign nations. At the same time, the population was increasing, the number of motor vehicles was increasing, and the number of refineries were decreasing. So, it became somewhat of alarming to us as 15, 20 years ago. But it really began sort of crystallizing in 2015, and then again in 2019, which are pretty significant years when you look at the history of oil and gasoline in our state. And so in 2019, I think a few of the alarms went off, but the legislature and the governor dismissed them. And then I know in 2022, some more alarms went off among the producers. They actually contacted the government and said, look, you know, this could be a very difficult situation moving forward. And in 2023, I personally informed the state legislature via a Senate hearing that we needed more production. So a lot of this was avoidable, and then we started seeing more and more harsh regulations being superimposed on the industry. So, things like that were happening.
So you're saying that the Saudi Arabia imports, that was just crude, or was that refined fuels?
Okay, it was crude.
Okay.
We didn't really start importing a lot of refined fuels until, say, the last 2-10 years, the increases of refined product has started to increase. And now, for 2025, they're at an all-time 20-year high. We've imported more gasoline from foreign sources in 2025 than we've had since, I think, 2004. So, and there's no abatement of that on the horizon. So we can, the only plan that the CEC has come forward with is importing more gasoline. That's it. They have nothing else to offer, and they haven't offered anything else to the people of California. And so they said, all right, we're going to increase more. Imports will increase. Yeah, port congestion will increase. Yeah, emissions will increase. And the price will increase. That's all we have to offer.
But what could go wrong?
So what could go wrong?
Right, what else?
What could go wrong when you have, three to five times more tankers on the Pacific Ocean coming to California in 2026 than you've had in 2024? What could go wrong? So, these are some of the issues we're going to look at, and we'll be happy to discuss these as we move forward.
Okay. And I heard a ding and a little bit of static. Sounds a wee bit like wind. So maybe Stan has blown in to join us.
Hi, everyone. This is Stan Ellis. How are you guys?
Hi, Stan. We joked about the California legislature tried to introduce you, and you weren't there. We're like, oh, no, they got him.
They got the stand.
we said California legislature, and then the sucking sound began.
Sounds like the assembly, frankly.
Yeah.
But anyway, thanks for having me on the show, you guys.
Yes.
I'm traveling, so if I happen to lose you, I'll call back in.
No sweat. The beauty of conference call lines, right? They're always there for you.
Yes, ma'am.
So, and My name is Aaron. So just so you have some voices to go with, yeah. Bill, say something.
Hi, Aaron.
Hello, Stan. Glad you made it.
So you've been watching this for how long?
Well, Michael Mish, Dr. Mish, and myself had met on a show, and he was so knowledgeable in, and he's been watching it for a lot longer than I have. And then this is about probably six months ago, and then we developed a relationship, and then Mike Ariza came to my office when I was in the state legislature and had done a really good job of summarizing the refinery end of it. I broke out in the oil field in 1975, so I have 50 years of experience in drilling, production, upstream and downstream. So the three of us had made a pretty good combination, and we came up with this. Looking at where we're going with our oil and gas production and our refining capacity, it was pretty simple to see that it's actually it is a risk to national security, and we really got worried. So we wrote a paper, and a professor did an incredible job, and so then here we are 6 months later trying to get the word out. And look, it's really a matter of national security, and I'm really worried. When you have Valero shutting down, and it Travis Air Force Base gets 100% of its fuel, a jet fuel from Valero, where's that going to come from? And then all of a sudden you look at the 40 some bases we have in California with which includes obviously, Air Force and China Lake and the other arms of the military, we have 40-some bases. And then we have Nevada, and part we're supplying. So what are we going to do? And then all of a sudden, and of course Russia knows this and China knows this. When they want to put a hurt on this, they drop a couple of those ships out, and guess what? We're in a gas crisis.
Yeah.
Not mm-hmm. just for the public, but for the military. And that's my concern.
We have to take a really quick break, but when we come back, let's start with Stan, because I'd like to hear, we'll give you 2 minutes to maybe switch to decaf, because I'd like to know what the other folks in the legislature are saying when you're bringing this.
It's a crisis?
When you're bringing this up, because I think I already know the answer, but we'll all switch to decaf. Going to take a really quick break. We have Mike Ariza here, who has been in the refinery business for a long time. We have Professor Michael Miche from USC, and we have Assemblyman Stan Ellis with us from the California Legislature. So that's our cast of characters today, and we're talking about the looming crisis in California with our refinery shutting down, which should alarm everyone, even if you don't live here. So we're going to come right back. You're listening to We the People. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
I'm going to do bad things, do it like it's nothing. Being bad has never felt so good. I'm going to do bad things, you won't see. Doing bad things to you.
Blame, you're about to give it, I'm about to take it. Yeah, we're going down in flames. What can we do when we're only human? Everybody makes mistakes. There's more than enough to go around. Blame, who said it first and who did it hurt? What the hell does it change? Why go there when I don't care? If you want to walk away,
it's about the best setup I got for you, Stan.
Yes.
Blame. So what's the response of your colleagues in the legislature when you bring up this topic?
Well, so there are 20 Republicans and 60 Democrats, and unfortunately, the Democrats, when I bring it up offline, they agree. But, and I'm on the Natural Resources Committee, and there are bills that try to come forth that want to penalize oil companies for emissions. And we put out the cleanest.
Uh-oh. The cone of silence is captured.
I'm sorry.
You broke up there, Stan. Go ahead and repeat what you were saying.
Yeah. So anyway, we put out the cleanest oil and gas in the world. And what's happening is that the green agenda and greenhouse gases emissions that the Democrats have put forth have made it appear that oil and gas is dirty. However, if that's the case, then why do we make 6,000 products from oil and gas and oil and gas derivatives? So the green agenda has ruined the oil and gas industry in California. And I'm the first one to say that we're going to run out of oil and gas for some future generation. Why wouldn't we, instead of spending $1 billion on high-speed rail, put it into fusion and put it into other alternative, you know, wind and solar a little piece, but fusion and fission and micronuclear are the real answers long-term. Mm-hmm. But until we get there, we need oil and gas. And so there's just no common sense. There's not a common sense transition. And to answer your question, the legislators, the Democratic legislators really don't get it, and they don't care to get it because they fall under Newsom's agenda, and his agenda is greenhouse gas, unfortunately.
Okay. So swing over to Professor Miché. So you've been watching this since 1974. So the fact that they're not getting it doesn't mean the results aren't going to happen.
Well,
to the state,
yes. I mean, so let's look at some data, okay? Just make it as simple as we can. So at one time, California was the world's leading producer and exporter of petroleum.
Wow.
We were number one in the world. Now, that was a long time ago, right? Even before I started following this industry. And we have the fifth largest oil reserves in the United States. So the petroleum industry, if you really sort of think about California, you have the gold rush, and then the next rush was the black gold rush, which was the oil rush, which began in around 1869 and went all the way into, you know, the 20th century. So petroleum played a huge part in the economic development of California. Now, the petroleum industry itself represents about 8% of the California GDP. But it's the first 8%. As Stan mentioned, you have petroleum in 6,000 products. If you have an EV, which is great, you're driving down the road on asphalt that's made from petroleum. By the way, your tires are made from petroleum, and your EV has about 4 or 5 quarts of oil in it to lubricate the parts that are moving. So, you know, it's one of these products that is essential to any modern economy. So we had this very significant and dominant position for years and years and years. And at one time, we had 40 refineries in the state, and now we're going to be down to 7. And probably by the end of 2027, probably down to 6. So we're looking at a decline. And some of the statistics that Mike Ariza mentioned, to put it more in sort of consumer terms, we're losing somewhere between 6.2 and 9 million gallons of gasoline a day in in-state production. That's how much our production is falling by a day. And so the question is, where is the state going to make that up? And the only answer that they have is, well, through imports. Great. They'll tell you that, but they won't tell you what the price effect of that will be. So in all instances, we're looking at price increases and the potential of supply shortages, because as Stan mentioned, you know, you're going to have 3 to 5 times more tankers coming across the Pacific Ocean. Anything can happen. A typhoon, labor disputes, geopolitical events. Anything.
Mm-hmm. Shuts off the supply.
To disrupt that supply.
Yeah.
And by the way, we run on about a 14-day supply in the state. That's what we run on. Now, the statistics will tell you that around...
Say that again? We have about 14 days...
Spare supply,
okay, in the state.
Oh, that's terrific.
At any one... Yeah, that's 14 days. That's it, though.
Yeah.
That's all you got. Okay? Now, what happens is, when it hits around 12 to 13 days, it's almost like a hockey stick in terms of the bend in the curve. It literally goes like 80 degrees straight up in price. So at around 12 to 13 days supply, that price is going to increase by at least $1 to $1.50 a gallon. So that's how tight supply is, and that's how fragile this inbound supply system will be. And that has implications for the California consumer, and it has broader implications for the following. A, Arizona. They get about 48% of their gas comes from California, slightly less now.
Wow.
Nevada, totally messed up. Over 80% of their fuel comes from California.
Oh, shoot.
And as Stan and Mike and I, we tried to bring out in our study, you know, not only are they affected, this California contagion effect will propagate on out into national security. And so, you know, we have a significant vulnerability that's being created by the loss of these refineries. And I might add, the loss of the North-South pipeline, which is generally called the Crimson Pipeline, which is collapsing as we speak. So these are some of these profound implications of these policies. And what we tried to do in our study is just simply bring them forward factually. You know, there's no real political agenda other than here's the numbers. And the numbers really aren't looking very good, and the numbers don't lie.
Hmm. Now, you said there was roughly, what, 6 or 7 refineries left in California. With the rest of these going out, are those refineries able to increase capacity, or are they kind of maxed out?
Well, Mike, I'll give the first answer, and Mike will give you the micro answer to that. I'll backfill it. They're pretty much maxed out. You can't run a refinery at 100% capacity. We all know that. The physics do not allow that. So when a refinery is running, say, between 88, 87, say, to 92, that's a really good sweet spot for the utilization. They don't really have a lot of upside on that because of the physics involved and safety and just the chemical processes involved in that refinery. So we're tapped out. Now, we can change the mix. It's what do you want? If you want more gasoline, then I'm going to produce less jet fuel and less diesel fuel. If I want more jet fuel, then I have to produce less diesel fuel and less gasoline. So the refiners, as a result of the policies, are really boxed into a corner. And so, like any refiner, they try to optimize their product mix. It comes out what we call the barrel, the products that come out of the barrel, okay? That slate, they try to optimize that, given the quality of crude that they have in the equipment they're running. And so I'll let Mike Azia walk you through the details of that.
You have, I don't know if you have the numbers, but... When speaking about the military, what percentage, what usage do they demand of the total output of what we're refining right now? How much of that has to go to the military? I mean, they use jet fuel, they use diesel, they use gas.
And this is in peacetime.
Yeah, exactly. So what are they using now, I mean, as far as a percentage of output?
I would have to look that up. I think that's in our study, and I think it's around 8 to 12% of the output.
Part of the problem, so I'll interrupt here for a second. Part of the problem is it's classified. So we don't know what their usage is, but we can only guess.
Oh,
that makes sense.
Yeah, it's about 8 to 12% what we know about. For example, we know that Travis burns through about 200,000 gallons of jet fuel a day just on normal operations. That's just nothing happening in the world, nothing extraordinary going on, nothing extraordinarily planned in terms of training or any types of exercises. So they go through about 200,000 gallons.
And that's one base out of 40?
That's one base out of 40. Depending on how you count them, you get up into the 50s.
Yeah.
You know, you have small bases, you have big bases, you have, you know, all sorts of little things. And then you have, let's not forget, that's just California. You have significant assets, military assets, based in Nevada and in Arizona. Significant Air Force assets based in both of those states. And in the case of Nevada, pretty much all of it is coming from California. So this entire state is pretty much dependent on whatever happens in California. And whatever price increases are in California, there's like a 97% correlation that the price will increase in Nevada. So we have a profound effect on the neighboring states and on national security.
Mike's got his calculator open. What's your calculator open for, Mike? What are you doing over here?
Oh, I know how much barrels jet fuel Valero produces a day, but I forgot how many gallons that is. So let's multiply that. Back to the professor's point, you know, Travis, if something happens in Taiwan or some other significant theater opens up, you're looking at, a KC-10 extender and a C-5 take roughly 100,000 gallons of fuel. Valero makes about 600,000 gallons of fuel a day.
Oh, boy.
And that's just one sortie between a fuel extender, 100,000 gallons right there. As far as, you know, Arizona, Phoenix is totally dependent on us. And when you look at the percentages in Nevada, well, you're looking at 80, 88%, different numbers. The bottom line is Reno and Vegas are totally dependent on us. So the three major cities, they're dependent on us. So we start running into shortages, which we will do. They're in trouble, prices, supplies. With regard to the refineries, Valero actually produces more gasoline per barrel of oil than any of the other refineries in the state. It was designed different. It was built differently. So you're going to lose a lot with Valero. Phillips 66 is already down in Wilmington. That takes us down to 8 refineries that are actually up of any size or capacity that are running. Valero goes down. Originally, they were slated to go down in April. Looks like they're going down next month. You're going to lose, like Professor said, the whole supply of jet fuel comes from Valero. And then a bunch of real-world events that have occurred in the last 2 to 3 months since we started embarking on this, me and the assemblyman and Professor. You've had a major fire at the Chevron refinery in El Segundo. You had a tanker, a fuels oil tanker bound for Singapore, hijacked in the Indian Ocean. You had a leak on the Olympic gasoline pipeline in Washington, shutting that down for a little while. So the other thing is storms. When I ran the Valero refinery, there were 3 separate times where I actually cut back Valero's crude oil rate because storms in Alaska were holding up the Alaska North Slope tankers from getting to us. A couple of times we cut from 135,000 barrels down to 100. One time we were about 6 hours away from totally shutting down because the storms were really severe and we were not getting enough. We can't run on 24,000 barrels a day of crude, San Joaquin Valley crude by itself.
Right.
You have to have supplements. When my wife went to visit her family, Hong Kong, Guangzhou, those big cities in China, typhoon went through, shut down the shipping for 2 or 3 days. So any of these real world events just leaves us extremely vulnerable, leaves the military vulnerable, and like Stan was pointing out, it puts the whole country at risk. If the West Coast is taken out, if our Air Force and Navy can't get airborne, it's all up and down. We know how long the state of California is up and down the coast. then you're affecting Arizona, you're affecting Nevada. We're in serious trouble. And that was initially why we got together on this, was take away the risk to our civilian population, because there will be major civil unrest. We saw how everybody reacted to toilet paper shortages.
Yeah.
When they get on their little app, you know, Gas Buddy or whatever, and say, okay, there's gasoline over here. They go over there. There's
and
no gasoline. And they're going to go crazy. And, you know, all of our metropolitan areas, L.A., San Francisco, Sacramento, you know, Phoenix, people are going to totally go crazy. And the military is going to suffer. The military is, it's been a risk since like 2 or 3 years ago when they shut down Marathon and put Rodeo in, the ConocoPhillips Rodeo refinery, put it on clean fuels, the diesel. That gasoline, that jet fuel, all that production took about 20% out right then 2 or 3 years ago. Phillips 66 in Wilmington took out another roughly 9 to 10%, and Valero's another 10 to 12%. So when Valero finally pulls the plug, between 40 and 43% of our gasoline is going to be imported across the ocean. And with all those things I mentioned, real-world events that have occurred,
yeah.
I forgot about the fire on the cargo ship in Los Angeles. It was so severe they had to pull it away from the port. You damage the port of Los Angeles, we can't get the tankers in.
Can't get them in.
Well, crippling us will be child's play.
And like the professor says, you know, you're down to 12-day supply. Price jumps up $1.50 a gallon.
We'll be lucky if that's all
there
is.
Those numbers better. Well, we get down to 8 days, 7 days. You know, that's where all three of us just totally concur. $8 a gallon is minimum.
Yeah.
The minimum what it's going to be within a few months.
And on that cheerful note, I have to be the fun killer and tell us that we have to take a break.
Yeah, I want to talk about location of these refineries, too, and how it affects regionally the supply and demand.
Sure.
When we return.
Sure.
And just so you have something to stew on during the commercial break, the terrific job that we're doing of making our own special fuel in California to make our own special air that is only over our own special heads is a 1% improvement. All this, we have hamstrung ourselves and walled ourselves off from the world for a 1% cleaner fuel. God, I can totally tell. Break time. You're listening to We the People. You can find us at WeThePeopleRadio.us. Belt wrapped around our minds and the regulation.
Yep. So Mike, with these refineries, I would imagine the Valero supplies the gas for Northern California, or does it really matter where they are, or are they very regional where their supply goes?
Typically, it's regional. With the El Segundo fire, I know a tanker was rerouted from the Gulf Coast away from the East Coast to Southern California, and some jet fuel was routed to Southern California from here. Once Valero goes down, that flexibility is gone. You'll only have Chevron and the PBF refinery Martinez.
So that's where you get into shortages.
Exactly.
There just isn't any.
It's just not there. It's not available.
Right. Wow. Yeah, there's going to be some unrest when that happens. I mean, people depend on their vehicles every day. You expect to go out, turn the key, and go. But if you can't get fuel, you can't go to work, you can't buy groceries.
Well, it impedes all the manufacturing and everything. So let's swerve over into the Assemblyman Ellis Lane here. Stan, any Any recognition of this by the California legislature, the people that are say, watching the regulators that are squeezing our lives into...
No. What's happening is they're so driven by this green agenda that they will not... All they want is tighter regulations. The Democrats put forth Bill 237, which allowed about 2,000 drilling permits in Kern County and exempted them from CEQA to get to work right away. But 2,000 wells over the next 10 years is a drop in the bucket, 40,000-50,000 barrels. But Aaron, I want to go back to your reformulated fuel comment that you made earlier.
Oh yeah,
you know, we're getting. So years ago, we spent billions of dollars getting our refineries from low sulfur spec and reformulated fuels, and they call it CARBOB here. And now we're getting so-called CARBOB from India, and we don't have regulatory agencies over there watching how clean they put out their how clean their emissions are. And then all of a sudden, we're putting this fuel and crude into ships that burn number six fuel oil. And number six fuel oil is loaded with polynuclear aromatic hydrocarbons like phenanthracene, cryosine, benzopyrene. And what happens is they put these out in the atmosphere, and all of a sudden 20 miles out when they get out from the port, they kick over to low-sulfur diesel. It's hypocrisy at its best.
Boy,
so
no
so
kidding.
You think we might get 1% better air? No. We're getting worse air. So I'm sorry, I had to go back to that, Aaron.
No, that's okay, because it makes no sense. The air above us doesn't, I mean, there, even children, you know, you don't even have to have this in school, because everyone knows
right.
The air moves around. So the air over California isn't the air over California for very long. So
the jet stream comes right across us.
Jet stream comes
right across us from the Pacific.
I guarantee you the air that was blowing me off the trail with the dog right before the radio station is in Ohio now. I mean,
but
Mike's not going to use any fuel going home at all. It's just going to blow him right back to Chico.
But back to your question about nothing's happening. I can put forth any type of legislation I want, but unless I'm a Democrat, it's not going to go anywhere.
God.
This is Professor Michelle.
Yeah,
I can add to that.
Please.
So in hearings back in June, the then chairwoman of CARB, California Air Resource Board, was asked directly, does CARB measure the effect of greenhouse gas emissions for the sources of oil, foreign sources of oil, at the wellhead, and did they measure the greenhouse gas emissions for all the tankers coming across the Pacific? And the answer was, no, we don't do that. So if you think about it, you're adding a significant amount of greenhouse gas emissions due to the 3 to 5 time increase in the number of tankers coming across the Pacific. I mean, it just doesn't seem to make sense to any of us that look at the math and understand the numbers. So the logic is really perverted. Let's not produce oil here, and let's shut down the refineries, but let's import it from places like Brazil. Well, I'll give you an example for Brazil, right, because it has to do with the AB 30 legislation for ethanol. So Brazil produces ethanol from sugarcane. Collectively, the estimates are that Brazil has burned 24 million acres of rainforest and jungles for agricultural production, a significant amount of which is sugarcane for ethanol, which, guess who imports that ethanol? California. So not only are we importing oil from Brazil, and their oil, by the way, is all deep water offshore oil, same way with oil off Santa Barbara coast in federal waters is all deep shore off. But nonetheless, you know, there's a bit of a hypocrisy among the policymakers and the regulators. Well, you know, we won't do with the full life cycle calculation of emissions. And that's an important factor for us. And we are working on that right now.
to get that information to them to make, I mean, I don't want to speed to the conclusion here, but like, what do you think will tip the scale for people who have their hand on the lever? Like, is there anything you can see?
No, I think Stan summarized it nicely. You know, he's a Republican, and there's a limited number of Republicans and a supermajority of Democrats. And as in Stan's case, in private, I've had Democrats come up to me and say, you know, Professor Mache, we really appreciate your work. We understand your numbers. They are alarming, but we can't really do much about it. And that's all they'll say. The best thing we can do is bring these issues, which we try to do in our study, Stan, Mike, and I, try to do in our study, bring these issues to the public, bring them to people like you who can get the message out in the public, and then get them to Washington, D.C., to policymakers at the federal level. With the amount of reductions we're looking at in gasoline, the vulnerability to the supply chain that's being created, the number of emissions that are going to result from massive amounts of oil tankers coming across the Pacific. I mean, they'll be parked outside of the waters trying to get in to unload, and heck, you can probably step across them to get to Hawaii. So that's a national issue. And so bringing it to the attention of national policymakers, such as the president, I think is in the best interest of not only California, but also the nation. So we're hopeful that President Trump and his administration takes a serious look at the work that's being done out here.
And that's the biggest part of the problem that we've been working on. With Phillips 66 going down, Valero, we're done. We're at 40-plus percent, 30, 35% of our jet fuel. That's where the vulnerability lies. And these refineries, you can't just start them back up. Valero is extremely complex.
If they shut one down, I mean, you can't just turn the key and turn it back on.
It could take weeks to months to start one back up. And the big problem is qualified personnel. You know, when I worked at Flying J, this is the part that's kind of ironic, was the Democrats back then, Barbara Boxer and Lockyer, they saw the logic in a 3 to 4% loss of gasoline production in California, which Flying J represented. They told Shell, we can't have that. The supplies could have a problem. The prices, you know, the price spikes in California are already paid too much. They figured it out at that time.
That's sad. Barbara Boxer is the smart one.
Well, that's the thing. And they basically forced Shell to sell the refinery to Flying J. But back to my point was a lot of the Shell employees had already set to transfer. A couple came up to Martinez back then, you know, transfer to Texas. Some just retired. And you lose that. You know, the longer it sits, the more you're retired. Once you've got it down and everything's cleared and you don't need operators, you know, they lay them off. They retire, transfer to other facilities. The dynamic with Valero that no one knows or understands is the fact that Valero, with its complexity of within the control room, you have one control room running eight major units. In another refinery, you have one control room and operators running one unit. So Valero, you know, you can get somebody to come help you that's got 30 or 40 years experience, but typically they'll have experience on the CAT unit or the crude unit or the sulfur unit.
Like that's like a
siloed. Right, like islands within the refinery.
Yeah.
At Valero, you're starting them all up at the same time, and that's where Valero is very problematic, because once enough qualified people have left Valero, you're going to find, I mean, me, it's been a while, I could probably do it, but, you know, you try to find other qualified people in the whole country
who can run all those different
facets
all at the same time.
At the same time.
And how many personnel does it take to run a Valero?
Well, they have 400. I mean, you get down to skeleton crew, probably, you know, 150. You have teams running through. Valero is unique because you did maintenance and you did operations. You did both because
right.
It was non-union. But the thing about the qualifications of running it is you got to have time.
Mm-hmm.
I learned how to run it from very qualified ladies and gentlemen that knew the CAT unit, knew the coker, but they, you know, they worked that and ran all of them at the same time. So, you know, it took four or five years before I was extremely proficient at it. So in another refinery, it takes you a year or two before you can go in a control room, you know, and start running one of their units. So
right. This
isn't something where you jump in, you learn how to run the drive-through, and you go.
Well,
this is
plus
very complex.
You blow up the industry, and, you know, people aren't going to necessarily want to flock back to California so they can get So they can get...
When they're gone, they're gone.
Yeah, ruined again.
And the thing
it's like
is...
like our sawmills. I mean, you look at how many industries we have... where we have done this.
Budweiser,
and now people are like...
Budweiser in Solano County is going down.
I forgot about that. There's that.
That's two big employers in Solano County, just Solano County alone. And then going back to your question about refineries and capacity, I was told a long time ago, and this is absolutely true, what a refinery does, they come back online from a shutdown, they put it up to 6,000 RPM, and they cut it back, throttle back 500 RPM, and you hold that for 3 years. That's their maxed out. They are permitted. There's permitted levels. Valero's originally was 135 when I was there. I think it's 145 now, 145,000 barrels a day. They can't.
Dang, we're out of time. Sorry. We have to go to commercials. I was all captivated.
And we're out.
Okay, bye.
Buns and donuts and fruitcake with no nuts. So good you could go nuts.
You're going to have all those things when you get home.
No, now. I want a ball. I want a party. Pink macaroons and a million balloons and performing baboons and give it to me. Now, I want the world. I want the whole world. I want to lock it all up in my pocket. It's my bar of chocolate. Give it to me now. I want today. I want tomorrow. I want to wear 'em like braids in my hair and I don't want to share.
It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it. And I feel fine.
California Legislature, the musical.
I feel refined.
Yeah, I'd like to feel refined. We thought we should change the music for you in the second hour since, I forgot to do it in the first hour. You're listening to We the People. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
You can find our archives at wethepeopleradio.us, and they are free to listen to, and we have removed the free enterprise moments, so it is uninterrupted listening. You can do whatever you want with it, and I really would encourage you to send this show to other people, because this is not a maybe coming down the road 10 years from now. This is, like, happening right now.
Happening now.
Right now, this minute.
It started 2 years ago.
Years
ago.
Yeah, so we're showing up late to the party, and we are unprepared. So go back to the things that we were supposed to be, guys.
Yeah, let's touch on the refineries again. You had some questions.
And then Stan was going to tell, Professor Miche was going to tell some other stats.
Yeah, if your math is wrong, if the professor tells you your math is wrong, your math is wrong.
God bless him.
Period.
God bless him.
The thing with the refineries, like I was saying, they're maxed out. Valero shuts down. And, you know, they're counting asphalt plants don't count. I've heard numbers from 11 to 10 to 9. No, right now, we are at 8 operational refineries that are of any significance. When Valero goes down, that's going to be 7. So right now it's imperative. We're pushing the document that was published in Washington that the three of us worked on. That document, the whole last paragraph, gives the exact ways that the president can intervene. And right now we need to intervene. We need that type of intervention. We're with the refineries down. They don't start up on a dime. It could take months to restart them, assuming you have the qualified personnel to restart them. So we need some type of intervention. And, like Valero, they went to the state capitol, and gentlemen, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the state legislatures, they offered them a couple $100 million, and Valero said no. And a matter of fact, not only are we not shutting down in April, we're going to shut down in January. So all efforts at this point need to be made to keep Valero open, and then we need to restart Marathon and Martinez. If it's possible, we need to restart that Phillips refinery down at Wilmington.
Well, the other piece, before we forget it again, was you were saying that from the Valero refinery, just in case people are thinking, oh, well, we'll just bring more fuel in by rail, or we'll just do some stuff like that. 92% of the fuel that was refined at Valero goes out through pipelines.
That's correct. 90+% of all the fuel, I'm sure it's the same for all the refineries, is piped. It's pipeline. It's pumped. It is not trucked out.
So it's piped throughout the state.
It's piped throughout the state. And as far as rail cars and trucks, the professor has really good numbers on that.
Scare us, Professor Miche. We're ready.
Well, I don't want to scare you, but you our do. Main pipeline is called the Crimson Pipeline. It goes north-south. And let's just say you wanted to replace 100% of its capacity. All right. It's operating well below that now. It's operating at like 15 to 18% of what it's capable of doing. It's dying as we speak. It's on life support. It's collapsing before our eyes. Now, to replace that pipeline, let's just say you wanted to run it at capacity, you would be adding over 200 trucks a day onto I-5 every day, bringing crude oil north to the refinery to replace that particular pipeline, around 266 trucks a day, every day, 365 days a year, that refineries operate. And so, that's another thing to take into consideration, given California has consistently ranked in the bottom, 20% of roads in the United States. So our infrastructure is crumbling, and the loss of the refineries in this industry is only going to accelerate that. I mean, take a look at these numbers, right? So since assuming office in January 2019, under Newsom, under his leadership, the number of drilling permits in our state plummeted by 97%. Oil production has fallen by 30%. Gasoline production has fallen cumulatively by about 22.3% because of the loss of refineries and conversion to renewables. The number of refineries has dropped by 22%. And our dependency on foreign, non-U.S. sources of oil has increased from 58% to this year probably hitting around 66 or 67%. And so now you wonder why the price of gasoline is going up. And these are just things that are outside of the normal taxes. Remember, in California, we have five levels of taxes and costs assigned to every gallon of gasoline. It's the highest in the country of regulatory costs, including cap and trade, which, by the way, let's not forget that 25% of cap and trade collected goes to the California High-Speed Rail Project, which is the train to nowhere.
Yeah.
So these policies have combined to have really detrimental effect on the California pocketbook, consumer pocketbook, and now a contagion effect to the other states of Arizona and Nevada, and national security implications. So, again, we're hopeful that our work, is circulated in D.C. We have, Congressman Kiley and Fong, I know, are aware of the work and have made statements on it, and of course, in Sacramento. But I do think it's probably time for a more prudent approach to California energy to prevail in our state, because this is an incredible industry. And keep in mind, when we're buying this foreign oil, we're shipping $60 million a day overseas to the countries that produce that oil. We could be producing that oil in state and keeping it here.
So I can hear Stan. He unmuted.
Sorry.
He's probably going to tell us something.
Well, I just wanted to let you know that I've been in business in California for 40 years in the oil and gas service business, and it is so unbelievable. I moved to different states in my businesses because California, the regulatory regime is unbelievable. I compare some of these regulatory agencies to the Gestapo. They can come out to your refinery at any time, and if they don't see something right, they write you a ticket, and then you have to fight it. So you have to have an army of environmental staff for air regulations, for the Department of Water Resources, there's 10 agencies that you answer to. I don't blame Valero for leaving. I don't blame every damn one of those refineries from leaving, because California has in its hypocrisy says we want the cleanest air in the world, and in fact, they're adding to emissions. That's all. That's all I need to say.
Yeah. So, Professor,
mic drop moment.
Professor, address the rail issue. We have people saying, "Oh, we're just going to rail it in on tankers." Is that even a possibility?
Well, thanks. It's not. Yeah, you can bring it in. But remember, a rail system is linear. So how many tankers are you going to need to bring in 6 million gallons of gasoline a day?
A day.
And how fast can you unload them? And then.
And where are you going to put it?
You know, how many, and where are you going to put it? You don't have storage capacity in the state for that amount of gasoline. It doesn't exist.
Structure.
The calculations that were done by the CEC are honestly wrong. All right. They said, "Oh, there's plenty of room for storage." It's not, doesn't exist. The refiners don't operate like that. And to build a tank farm is at least $35 million per tank. Probably 1 or 2 years to build it, assuming you can get the permits.
Wow.
Not going to happen in time. So you know, we're railing in ethanol from back east, from the ethanol producing states, Iowa, Nebraska, Minnesota, places like that. Kansas, but to bring in gasoline is an entirely different set of logistics. And then where are you going to find that gas? Because remember, it's California special blend. And so refiners don't make that. It's not like you can call up a refinery on the Gulf of America, the coast, and go, "Hey, I need 6 million gallons of gasoline and get it here." No, it's California special blend. So the rail idea, although we'll bring in some supply, is going to fall woefully short of what's needed.
Hmm.
And it's more expensive. Look, the least expensive way of moving fluids, everybody will tell you, is through a pipeline.
Sure. So, the other involves all sorts of other people. And
risk.
And the other safety. Thing I was talking to when Mike and I were on the phone for like 3 hours about this, at which point I was like, okay, this is crazy. We've got to tell everyone. You were telling me the storage isn't storage. Like, storage is specific.
Well, they're counting yeah. tanks. We've had this, you know, Professor Althaus has had this discussion. There's only X amount of product tanks. You got crude oil tanks. You got coker feed tanks, cat feed tanks, sour water tanks, intermediate tanks. So there's a bunch of tanks that are not product tanks. The actual product tanks, when you look at a gasoline, jet fuel, diesel, it typically in a refinery, it's about a third of the tanks you see are actual product tanks that are shipped out. The other tanks, almost all the other tanks, they can't be used for product. They cannot be used for product storage for gasoline, jet, or diesel.
So a tank is not a tank.
That's correct.
So a product tank, does that, you say it's shipped out, does that go out on a pipeline?
Yeah, basically the refinery, you come in 135,000 barrels a day, you got distillation, you got conversion in the refinery, you're making gasoline, jet, and diesel. Valero was designed to make as much gasoline as it could get out of every barrel of oil. In a typical refinery, you're looking at 50 to 55% of its crude oil rate is converted to gasoline. At Valero, that's closer to 70 to 72% because they don't make extra jet, they don't make extra diesel. But basically, you're making what you can, meeting your contractual commitments. You fill up a product tank, a premium jet, whatever. They'll do all level samples of that tank. And then once those come in good, then that tank is shipped off into the Bay Area. There's two different, Kinder Morgan, and I forget the other
in
one
a
now.
Pipe.
In a pipe.
Okay.
It goes to those different facilities, or sometimes it will go direct. Like the professor had said, Valero supplies Travis with all of its jet fuel. And that's the pipeline going down 680 through the Susut Marsh up north as it's heading to Sacramento and line laterals to Travis on the way. And that's how they get their jet fuel. But yeah, that's how it's done.
And so when that refinery is not there, they're just not getting jet fuel.
That's correct. The potential is there. Where, like, you know, professors mentioned, how many tankers are coming in? And Stan, you know, how many tankers are coming in? Well, we're at the point, you know, Valero goes down. We're already trying, we're maxed out on what we can bring in. And the slightest hiccup You got 14 days supply. You get down to 12, you're $1.50 a gallon higher. And, you know, any one of those factors that we have mentioned before, unscheduled refinery downtime with the six that will be remaining, you know, someone's hijacking a tanker, some storms holding up, then
sure.
Our supply goes down. We're at $10 a gallon, $12 a gallon. Then we're in shortages. And the military, that's the big threat for the military. And the civil unrest that I foresee occurring is just unreal. It's
well, sure, most people, you know, most working people, they can't afford $12 a gallon.
Yes.
I mean, they'll do everything they can to...
Well, and I think we all remember sitting in the gas lines. I mean, that was a time thing. I had just gotten my driver's license, and we had just moved here from Connecticut. So, I mean, I was living the dream, right? I got to drive the family car. Of course, I was just sitting there holding the wheel, but I was still in it.
Yeah, there's no pipelines.
That's not cool for me now.
The thing about California, it's an island. It literally is a fuel island. There are no pipelines coming into California. Uh-huh. Nothing. It all has to come by sea.
Mm. Okay.
And we can't get it from Texas because, what is it again? It's the, you have to search, what is it, Professor?
You have the California Special Blend, and yeah, you know, there are times when Texas refineries have stepped up and provided product to us. A lot of times what happens is, you're going to love this, the base product, petroleum is produced in Texas or Louisiana, it gets shipped to the Bahamas. It gets mixed in the Bahamas to create the California Special Blend.
Oh, my God.
Then it's shipped as imported gasoline through the Panama Canal back to California.
No, no, Professor, I don't love that. You were right.
Yeah,
I don't love that.
It's absurd. Right. I mean, and now we're looking at offshore production. So there's one company in particular called Sable Offshore, and their wells are located in federal waters off the shore of Santa Barbara. Now, they've just been approved for use of the pipeline. The pipeline that brings that oil onshore has been designated an interstate pipeline versus an intrastate pipeline. Therefore, as an interstate pipeline, it comes under the purview of federal regulatory agencies. So they're about ready to use it, but of course they were sued the other day, and a bunch of groups are seeking an injunction against it. But it's used. But their production would go, theoretically, if they can't use that pipeline, here's where their production would go. They would produce the oil. It would go onto a barge. The oil would be brought to the port of L.A. The tanker that just unloaded Iraqi oil or Saudi oil or Brazilian oil into California would now be loaded with California oil. That tanker would then turn around and sail to South Korea. That oil would be turned into California-compliant gasoline and then imported back into California.
Dear God.
That's the absurdity of some of these rules and regulations that the state has passed. And again, these are all self-created issues.
Yeah, right. This is all self-inflicted.
It's all self-inflicted, right? And for the California consumer, you know, they're looking at price increases. Just to import the gasoline itself is going to add anywhere from 10 to 17 cents a gallon.
Yeah.
Just to get it on the ship and get it over.
Sure.
All right.
Sure. Anytime somebody touches it, it gets more expensive.
But here's the key. So California has done a really great job at legislating the refiners out of business, right?
Yeah, they're really good at that.
So the gasoline is now coming from foreign refiners, right? So how much influence is the governor of California going to have and the California legislature going to have on, let's say, South Korea, India, or China? So we will be at the mercy of those refiners and whatever their pricing policies might be.
Yeah.
So it's sort of a remarkable abdication of authority and power to a foreign authority, all right? It's startlingly remarkable. And then again, that has national security implications that we brought out in our paper. Very, very profound national security implications.
Sure.
Dear
God. So, I mean, it's sort of, gee, what part of the story are you missing?
Yeah.
But I'm told that Governor Newsom is going to introduce legislation that's going to regulate the Chinese Communist Party. That's what I'm told.
You know, I'm pretty sure that's a thing. Phyllis, I hate to break it to you, but we have to take another break. And Ozzy Osbourne wrote a terrific song for us that I believe encapsulates some of what we're going to be experiencing. And, oh, my gosh. Anyway, you are listening to We the People. You can find us at WeThePeopleRadio.us. So, Stan, I have teed you up perfectly with the Crazy Train and the Twilight Zone. So, from the California Assembly perspective, any possibility they'd be willing to set aside the special regulations on our special gas so that we could just get gas?
There could be a chance that they could relieve carbon, but there's refineries that are already set up to make it so that the impact, my opinion, is insignificant.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And then one thing that does concern me, you know, we're getting this international product. Is it really up to CARB spec? So, and how close is it? Is it off a little bit? And what are we allowing? And what are the regulatory agencies allowing because they know we're under this crunch and they feel it? I don't know. But I can tell you that legislatively, it wouldn't make much difference if we said, hey, give us a little less spec, because we can already get less spec. I think we already, the ethanol thing came up too. So I don't know. I just have no confidence in our legislature. That's all.
What could federal intervention do for us? I mean, what power could they put on the California government to make this better?
If we could federalize oil and gas and throughout the whole state from production and well stimulation to and get rid of a CEQA and get the CARB specs back to the EPA standards like the other refineries in the U.S. have to meet, instead of such a trite, the reason we have a CARB is because the regulations are tighter than the rest of the country. You get rid of CARB, get rid of CEQA, and you
and just for those
get rid of
who,
a lot of the permitting issues in the state. Guess what? We're back to energy independence.
Yeah, and for the people who don't live in California or who don't speak acronym, CEQA is the California Environmental Quality Act, and that is an extra layer of regulatory over the any of the federal regulations. And then CARB is what you get when you have term limits and you put the bureaucracy in charge. We have the California Air Resources Board, and they run virtually unchecked because we have no people that are there long enough to really worm in and make effective change, and we're completely run by the Democrats.
Well, and if Spoiler you don't alert. Make it if you don't make it a federal issue, there's nothing to stop the California government from turning around 2 terms from now and laying it all back on us again, and that is, I think, part of the reason the refineries don't want to come back. It's like they have no guarantees.
Yeah. They'll just be crushed.
That they're going to just get crushed again.
Well said. I agree. That's part of the reason they don't. In fact, I almost sometimes wonder if the feds want us to fail and go through something catastrophic, that when they do come in, They can make, you know, look where Newsom stands. He wants to run for president.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The only reason he pushed through that bill at 237 to allow those drilling permits, they weren't going to allow that. But the only reason they did it, because he felt a little pressure, so he said, oh, look, I gave all those big oil companies all the permits they needed. So when they fail, it's their fault.
And it sounds like a lot of permits, but you had said, give us the numbers again on the permits and where that fits in the scheme of things.
There were a couple of thousand permits, and if you put in average well drilled in Kern County is 20, 25 barrels a day, that's 50,000 barrels a day.
Yeah.
We're importing a million. It's insignificant.
Okay,
it is. Totally.
Yeah, I thought we should probably revisit that. Professor, you guys talked in your paper about three possible things that the Trump administration could do to kind of help us or fix it. Or
yes, and again, you know, we've engaged. If you look at people like Brian Jones and Shannon Grove and Kevin Kiley and Vincent Fong. They've been out front on this for a long time and have done their very, very best. But I think at this point, given the magnitude of the problem and the fact that it is collapsing right in front of us and nothing has been done. And by the way, 237 is not going to produce a whole lot. We wrote a paper on that. I did with two professors from the University of California, Berkeley. And AB 30 is not going to be the answer either. So I think at this point, we need to get federal government intervention in place. I think the president needs to seriously consider invoking the Defense Production Act. And that, what that would do is puts, for lack of anything else, a prophylactic around California's oil and refinery assets, pipeline assets, and sort of carve them out from underneath the punitive regulations of California and some of the political dogma that drives that and the ideology about climate change, and put it back in under the responsibility of the federal regulators. That would increase production substantially, and I would say that within, 6 months to a year, you would have a significant reduction in consumer prices. At least a dollar a gallon less. So, that's kind of what we identified in our, that is what we identified in our report, in our study, and in subsequent studies that we've done too. So, I think at this point, we're really begging for federal intervention.
So by doing that, you're basically keeping California's hands off the oil production and gas production in California and controlling it federally rather than by the state.
That's true. It would be the best interest of the nation. It would be in the best interest of Arizona and in Nevada and also the California consumer. Mm-hmm. Prices will come down considerably.
Yeah.
The main thing is averting all those shutdowns that have occurred and are occurring, like with Valero. You got the National Emergencies Act and the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution. Also, the president might be able to invoke those to bring
it's
back.
It's happening now. I mean, if they shut those things down all the way, you're looking at months or longer to get them back online.
Yeah, and the thing is, like I've said a couple times already, it started 2 or 3 years ago with the Marathon converting Rodeo to renewable diesel, Phillips 66, Valero and Bedecia, and the professor was saying that he's pretty sure that they're looking at possibly shutting down Valero's refinery in Wilmington. That'll take us down to 6. The CEO of Chevron has mentioned about the fact that there's been a war against the refineries for 25 years, and I can't quote him exactly, but he was saying something along the lines of, we're not saying we're going to leave, but you know, at the same time, if regulations don't change and change fairly soon, they're looking at it too. And I mean, there's no way that can be made up from overseas.
No, and I would think anybody looking at that has to know that it's not a bluff when you look at who's already pulling out.
Yep.
You know.
That's true. This is Mache. It goes a little bit further, right? So if you dive into the financial statements of some of these refiners, you'll find that Valero has already written off pretty much 100% of its Wilmington refinery operation. So it's written off pretty close to it or at 100%. So as far as they're concerned, Wilmington is no longer a significant financial asset on their balance sheet. Along with Chevron, Chevron's written off somewhere between $3.5 and $4.5 billion worth of assets in the state of California on their combined balance sheets. And as you well know, they vacated their headquarters in Northern California, in San Ramon area, for Texas. They're now operating their company out of Houston. Mm-hmm. So, these are harbingers of things to come. The surviving refineries in California will, sooner or later, have to confront a similar situation. And think about this. Suppose you only had three or four refineries left. Now, what the state has banked on is the EV revolution.
Mm-hmm.
And in their projections, they actually have pretty close to 100% of all vehicles in California being EV by 2045, according to the CEC. Now, there's no way that's going to happen because not all vehicles lend themselves to EVs. So we understand that. We understand also that in cold climates, not that we have a lot of them, but we have mountains in California, that EVs get on whole about 25% less range than they do in warmer climates. But more so is the power for the EVs still comes from fossil fuels.
Right. How are they going to charge them?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Where are they going to charge them? You know, you get 40, at least in California, 40 to 45% of our power, electrical power, is generated from a fossil fuels.
Sure.
So, but yet we still have the second highest utility rates or the third highest utility rates in the country. So, it's a fantasy in those terms. The adoption rate for EVs now is less than 23%. The CEC and CARB had it at 35% coming into 2026. These numbers will not materialize.
I understand.
The demand for gasoline is not falling by the rate that California has said it was going to fall. It's not.
Not to mention the fact that you have to drive an electrical vehicle 122,000 miles before it becomes carbon neutral. Another hypocritical point.
Oh, my God. It just gets better and better. Well, we had somebody on, 2 years ago, who was telling us he was in one of those early meetings where they came up with 17% renewable as their target. And they started with 15. They thought that sounded too low. They decided 20 would be good. And he just sitting there listening. And then they said, well, 20 is kind of high. Maybe we should go 17. And he's like, you guys, what are you basing this on? Like, I don't see any studies. There's no paper. Like, did you guys not give me all the information for the meeting? And they got all mad at him. They turned on him like a pack of dogs. And they said, we haven't gotten that far yet. And he's like, but don't you think we should do that before we pick a number? Yeah, they didn't think that. So, I mean, that's where these goals come from. So the fact that there's nothing to back them up is, like, not really shocking.
But Aaron, apparently that hasn't changed.
No, it hasn't.
Producer, because when you ask them, like, well, how did you derive this curve?
Right.
Can you show me the mathematics behind this curve? Can you show me the assumptions and the data, and can you show me your equations? And the answer is, well, we don't have any.
You're a monster for asking them to show their work, Professor. What are you thinking? We all know that it's about feelings.
He is thinking. That's the problem.
You're really going to tell me that you're going to have a 1,260% increase in EVs over the next 15 to 20 years.
Yeah.
You're really telling me that?
Yeah, hard pass.
Under what conditions? And so the latest answer that I got was solid-state battery technology. Now, that could be a game changer. There's no question about it that solid-state battery technology is something they get really, really excited about. But when you look at who's deploying it, which will be in particular Toyota and Mercedes, they're deploying it on the high-end cars, starting at $108,000, going up to like $158,000.
Oh.
And they're only going to put it on 20,000 units. So it's not going to have any significant impact on California gasoline consumption, because not a whole lot of people want to drive around a $150,000 EV.
Yeah. Yeah, no kidding. And some of the companies, like we were behind something yesterday, and Bill said the company doesn't even make them anymore.
Well, that's the problem. Is a lot of the auto manufacturers now are really kind of backing off the EV because they're losing money. Look at Ford. They just, I think the second time now, they've canceled that Ford Lightning. People don't want it. And so they
canceled the F-150 line. So Ford's cumulative losses on all EV sales over the last, I think, 4 or 5 years has been something around $35 billion.
Yeah. Yeah,
which is more than three times their profits. More than three times their profits.
Yeah.
So
how can you expect them to stay on that train? You know,
back to Ozzy Osbourne again, but we've already played.
Yeah. Then you go to the dealers and you ask dealers about them, and they'll sit there and they'll say, "Look, they're sitting on my lot for 80, 90 days. I can't sell them." You know. So you know, the adoption rates, when you ask the CEC, show us the math, show us the data, show us the assumptions, show us the equations, we're not getting those. And so you really have to begin to question the credibility of the numbers.
Yes.
I think that ship has sailed, as they say. And there's a clog at that port, too. They just keep doing it. We have to take a little break because you should. We should play a song called Madness, because it just seems like that's all there is. That's all there is in front of us, just more madness. You are listening to We the People. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
I can't get these memories out of my mind. And some kind of madness has started to evolve. I tried so hard to let you go, but some kind of madness is swallowing me whole. Yeah.
Oftentimes it happens that we live on.
I'd like to tell you I'm struggling for music today, but actually, I'm not. We've got more choices than we can shake a stick at. And just for people...
I'm telling you, these are great choices.
I know. We could talk for hours, and I've still got more great choices. I believe we'll... Oh, the one I'm going to splice in at the end of the first hour is Willy Wonka. You know, I want it now. I want to party. That'll be perfect. So in the archive, you'll have the joy of hearing that. And just another acronym that we've been throwing around that we never actually explained is the CEC, is the California Energy Commission. That's what we've been referring to for like the better part of 2 hours. So for people who are annoyed at us thinking, what are they saying? It's the California Energy Commission, the bane of our existence, next to the California Air Resources Board and the Water Quality Control Board, and oh my, we could go on. so many options. Okay, so not that this is the only program we're probably ever going to do on this, because we, I knew we would run out of time and have still a million things left to explore. We've got, say, 15, 14 minutes. What do you think, guys? What are we missing? What do people need to know today?
I think we want to leave people with the following, that the refineries are exiting. More will exit over the next 3 to 4 years. We're pretty sure of that. The pipeline is collapsing, and this is all due to regulatory actions and policy actions, and also an attitude, that's detrimental to doing business in the state. And that's the first thing. The second thing is to become engaged. Get a hold of your assembly member. Get a hold of your senator in both the state and at the federal level. And let them know your opinion of this, because price increases are coming and supply issues are coming, and they can be avoided. But there isn't enough action to do that. And thirdly, support, honestly, the idea of the Defense Production Act being important, and the idea of President Trump taking some deliberate action to help relieve the stress on California. So those are the three things that I would like to leave the folks with and ask them to think about.
Yeah, and the other part of that, too, is if you have people who are deeply down the environmental rabbit hole, thinking that this can all be averted and we're just, you know, the president, of course, would be a monster for interfering in California, whatever, since we just got done with Prop 50. We did a bunch of shows on that with the redistricting so we could wipe out the rest of the Republicans in the state. If they think that this is going to work for them, I do believe they should listen to the show several times.
And it's not.
That makes sense. It's not.
I'm a solution-oriented. I've been solving problems my whole life in chemical process and quantum physics. And so there's a solution here. It's get rid of CEQA, get rid of CARB, and get rid of cap and trade. If you got rid of those three things, our industry would flourish overnight and you'd see an economic boom in California. And furthermore, the environmentalists and the greenies that claim that they want all these green items and greenhouse gases and all these issues, then they should not drive an internal combustion engine nor an electric vehicle. They should not ride a bicycle. Nor should they even brush their teeth because of the glycol, the derivative from oil and gas. Thank you very much.
Do you approve that message, Stan?
I do. Spot on.
and the thing is, we're heading, it's like I initially got into this, we're heading on a path for the largest economical collapse of any state in the history of this country. That's where we're going to go. The civil unrest, the threat to the military. It's like the professor's saying, it's not a matter of if, it's coming. It's almost upon us now. We need the intervention, and we need it pretty darn quick.
Yeah, so if you can't convince them that $12 gas, I was speaking with someone who said, well, I'll just take the bus. I'm like, unicorn dust? What exactly powers that bus? Yeah. Like, what are you thinking?
Well, also, if you think about it for a minute, what drives all of our food prices? It's the price of fuel, and how do we distribute that? And because of some of these, we have 33 million gas and electric vehicles in California. How do you think we get our food? How do you think farmers farm? Where do you think our water comes from? From electric power, which is 80% oil and gas, or gas. It's not just gas that we have to worry about. It's food and food prices and not getting food delivered to the stores and gas. We are headed for a disaster if we're not careful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I had a person the other day try to convince me that we didn't pay freight on groceries. it's like, what are you talking about? You pay freight on everything. And that's, you're absolutely right. I mean, it's going to impact pricing right straight across the board on everything. And
that's right.
It's inevitable.
Yeah. Are you guys getting, are you having any increase in your audience for this message?
Professor, I think that's a good question for you. You've been the most active.
Yeah, I think so. I think we're getting quite a bit of interest, a lot of questions, a lot of momentum, certainly a lot of awareness. People will literally come up to me and say, "Aren't you the guy that you know, was on TV or on the radio that was talking about gasoline and national security and things like that? And the answer is, yeah, I am. Wow, I didn't realize that, you know, this is what was happening in the state. Is it really collapsing? And the answer is, yeah, here's the math, here's the number of refineries, and here's the production, and here's the amount of imports that are going to be required to satisfy demand. And then here are the vulnerabilities of the supply chain. So I think there's a growing awareness of that. But again, it comes down to how engaged do people want to be. But when they start seeing the price of gasoline go up and the price of food, as we talked about, mm-hmm. there's a direct correlation between the price of crude oil, the price of gasoline, and the price of food. Very well-established mathematics on that. And so when they start seeing that go up, then I think, you know, you're going to see more public discussion on it, but I think we're making some progress on it, and we need more engaged citizens, and we need more engaged politicians.
Yeah, because it's this isn't something. It's no different than any of our other things, our other bad moves we've made. You know, we got rid of timber, the mills closed. Now we're realizing, oh, that was a bad move. But you're not going to get mills to move back in. We just lost another one in Siskiyou County, what, a week ago, 2 weeks ago, up in Weed.
Yeah.
So, you know.
Losing the mills, right? And then because the production of in-state oil production has fallen so precipitously, there's, you know, where did the crews go? Well, they went to Texas,
mm-hmm.
right? They went to New Mexico. They went to North Dakota. They, you know, some of them, you know, a little bit to Colorado. And so you're sitting in Texas and you're making a pretty nice wage out there. You know, you can make $150,000, $200,000 on a crew, on a rig, or in a refinery, working overtime and things like that. Are you really going to want to come back to California? To the highest cost of living in the United States, to the highest taxes, to the highest gasoline, to utility rates that are 38% higher than the national average? You're on to move your family back to that?
Yeah.
That's a problem. So not only do we impact directly, you know, the industry, we impact the supporting infrastructure of that industry. As Mike pointed out earlier, the refinery workers, you know, once they leave, they're not going to come back.
No. No, that just doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
Stan?
I want to tell you a quick...
Yeah.
Oh, go ahead.
No, it's okay. I could hear you queuing in.
I have a quick story. I was applied for permits in the South Coast, air permits in the South Coast Air Quality Management District, and both of them were identical pieces of equipment. And we got our permit conditions back, and we went to operating, and we missed a condition on one of the permits, although they were identical. The Air Board issued two different permits, and we didn't catch it. 6 months later, they fined me $825,000. That's one example of many I have over the years of our Air Board and its Gestapo techniques. I'm telling you, we need to get rid of some of these regulatory agencies or the whole state's going to be out of business. Why do you think Anheuser-Busch is leaving? Why do you think Burger King left? Why do you think why do you think I'm moving my businesses out of California? For the same reason. Regulation is insane.
And then the fine that they slapped on Valero for a unit that generates hydrogen and carbon dioxide, okay?
Yes.
They were claiming carcinogens, reproductive harm. They said for the last 20 years, well, here's a newsflash for you, Air Board. They've been online since 69. There have been no elevated cases of cancer in Benicia, the refinery, the industrial park. So they levied them with an $82 million fine. And coincidentally, they changed the way the fine was distributed. So I forget the percentage, but Benicia, the offended community, which had no issues, was given $40 or $50 million of the fine. And the mayor of Benicia's on the Air Board.
Gee.
Help me out here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, meanwhile, with the closure of Valero, Benicia's losing 20% of its tax revenues.
Yeah, well, I couldn't, I guess I could believe it, but I couldn't believe it. That Chevron had been in California for 140 years. I didn't even know we had oil and gas for 140 years. I guess I hadn't really thought about it. But 140 years and they bailed. That's,
We've had, We've had oil in California for millions of years. So very quickly, California is very unique in the sense that, and there was a great piece of work written by a professor at Berkeley. His name is James Rector. And he wrote it on oil seeps. And so what he found is that oil, because of the geography of California, very quickly, oil is constantly being created beneath our feet. And that's why when the early settlers got here, the early Spanish explorers came, they literally found pools of oil all over California, bubbling up. The La Brea Tar Pit is probably the best example that you have of a seep. It just comes up out of the ground. So we've always had oil here. It's just been just a fascinating history of it. And it's been such a critical part of our economy and the way our economy developed.
Well, and it's
Go ahead.
No, I just was going to say, and it's definitely not ruining the world, you know.
So if you take the oil seeps that came up naturally offshore, and then we started producing offshore, and those seeps subsided, we don't get credit for that.
No.
Well, the fact that we don't consider hydro, large hydro as a renewable energy source, should just make everyone angry.
Yep.
All right, wow.
Time.
Say that again.
And having more water storage. If you had more water storage and all of a sudden you're growing more crops, you have all the CO2 sequestration you needed.
Right. Besides the fact that CO2 is stupid and it's not ruining the world. And if we didn't have enough CO2, we wouldn't have any plants at all. But we'll beat that in the head on a different day. Oh, my gosh. So Assemblyman Stan Ellis has been with us. Professor Michael Miche from USC has been with us. Mike Ariza from Chico by way of Valero by way of Fairfield has been with us here in studio. And we are going to talk to these guys again on a different day, all together or separately, because this issue isn't going anywhere fast and absolutely needs to be exposed. We hope you'll send this archive to the public. You can find it at wethepeopleradio.us.
Welcome to the Hotel California. Champagne on ice, and she said, we are all just prisoners here of our own device. And in the master's chambers, they gathered for the feast. They stab it with their steely knives, but they just can't.